This is the State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. When Clyde Edgerton was a boy living just outside of Durham, his mother took him to a nearby airport to see the airplanes and to have his picture taken. One of those photos of Clyde, clad in a white linen shirt and shorts, waving in front of a sleek dual-colored aircraft, is on the front of Edgerton's latest book. It's called Solo, My Adventures in the Air. Well, planes became a recurring theme in Clyde Edgerton's life as he joined the Air Force, flew combat missions in Southeast Asia, and later, home in North Carolina, owned and crashed a Piper tail dragger. After 8 best-selling novels, Solo is Clyde Edgerton's first foray into nonfiction, a memoir, and Clyde Edgerton is with us today in the studio. Hi there.
Hi, Melinda. It's nice to be here.
Welcome back.
Thanks.
Well, you live in Wilmington now, so I have to ask, how'd you get through Ophelia?
Well, the power went out yesterday about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, so we were without power for a while. But same as the commentators noted, mostly clean up, branches down around, and that was about it. It wasn't terrible for us.
Right. Well, if you want to join our conversation today with Clyde Edgerton, our number's 1-877-962-9862. That's 1-877-962-9862. But don't call for flying tips, because in the book, Clyde, you say with a statement that this is not meant to be an instruction manual, at least about how to fly.
That's correct. I did, because I knew that I would not be remembering all the little bits and pieces that I needed to remember to instruct.
Mm-hmm. But there are some great images in Solo, and I was wondering right from the first page if you might read to us about the dining room table.
This is from the introduction. You stand at the end of a long dining room table that is bare except for a single toothpick lying there in the middle, pointed toward you. The toothpick is a runway from 2,000 feet up. You are alone in a little airplane. You are sweating, just home from your first solo cross-country flight. And as for that toothpick, you must somehow get a big spoon, your airplane, to land on it and stay on it, or you will die. I dreamed of coming home from a solo flight soon after I was old enough to look into the sky and see an airplane. Sometimes a dream's realization falls short of the dream. Occasionally a dream and its realization match, and then we feel lucky. For me, flying airplanes has trumped any dream of it. I could never have dreamed the hypnotic beauty of a lake of clouds scooting just below the belly of my aircraft, of towering cumulus cloud formations to my left and right. And I have been blissfully alone while flying solo, tucked securely in my protective cockpit, far away up there in a tiny spot in the wide sky, finding a peace that, as the Bible says, passeth understanding. Aircraft engine and engine instruments have become, along with airframe and landing gear, an extension of my nervous system.
Clyde Edgerton, from the introduction to his latest book. It's called Solo, My Adventures in the Air. You know, that last line about engine instruments becoming an extension of your nervous system gets to the question of whether flying can ever be instinctive, or do you always have to rely on instruments? Because I have read that sometimes you could be flying upside down and not know it. And be heading into a spiral toward the earth, and you could think everything is just great.
Because, exactly.
Because your head tricks
you. You've read what the people who trained me in the Air Force were very aware of, and that is that you must stop trusting the feelings in your body when you're flying in instrument conditions. Now, when you can see the ground, and you can see your wings, and you can see you're okay generally, but if you're in clouds, then you may feel like you're turning to the left and you're going straight ahead. And there are all kinds of fun little tricks that are played upon us in pilot training to help us lose our trust in our bodies and gain trust in the instruments.
Mm-hmm. How long does it take to break that thing of saying, well, I can go with my gut instinct?
Well, it takes a few. We were in a large room, and there was this long arm that set out, almost like the arm of a clock, that would go around and around, and we would be sitting on the end of that arm, and we would be blindfolded. And someone would be saying, okay, what direction are you going in? And you'd feel that you're going to the left. You say, I'm going to the left. And then you would feel like you were slowing down, and then you would feel like you were stopped. And the questioner would say, what direction are you going in? You say, well, I feel like I'm stopped. I'm not moving at all. He says, take off the blindfold. And you open the blindfold and you're very slowly going to the right. Or some other combination of this. And then you get an airplane at night over Texas where I was training. And on the ground, there are little lights from houses that look like stars. And above there are stars. And your instruments are covered up. And the fellow in the back gets the aircraft into an unusual position in the air, maybe halfway on your back with a wing low, and then he turns loose and says, recover. So you rely on your, and you're high enough to not be in any danger. So you start recovering the aircraft, and he finally says, are you straight and level? And you say, yes, I think so, but your airspeed's in, and then you lose it. And then he'll remove or ask you to remove the cover from your instruments, and then you recover. And then you go through, and finally you are relying on your instruments and recovering, and you see that you can't do it without those instruments. So this takes some while, and by the time you finish your instrument training, you know not to rely on the seat of your pants.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny, because back in the 20s and 30s, before people knew about this, guys were flying into clouds, and if they made it out, they would say, gee whiz, airplane starts doing strange things in clouds. And they thought it was something to do with they couldn't understand it, but they finally figured out that it was your perception.
So it was your mother who encouraged you to fly.
She didn't exactly encourage me to fly, but she, from early on, she was the type who would take me out to see and to, for example, she took me to see when I was about six, she took me to see the electric chair in Raleigh. Actually, it was a gas chamber chair then, but she, and it wasn't the
same. So you did not want to become a prison warden.
It was between flying or dying, so I chose flying. But she, besides taking me to the electric chair, she took me to the airport, which Raleigh-Durham was just, this is in the late 40s, it's just a little crossroads and just maybe one runway, I don't remember exactly. But you could walk out and you could meet the pilots, the commercial pilots, and they would say hello. You could walk almost to the airplane. It was very different than it is now. And she wanted me to see it. And I don't remember a lot about it. I remember being there and being impressed. But there were four photographs left from that time, which she took, and one of them ended up on the cover. And that was a lost photograph until about just a few months before the book came out.
Mm-hmm. And another inspiration to go into the skies that you write about is something that's a relic from an earlier day when we did not have 24-hour-a-day television stations on the air. There used to be TV stations that would sign off.
Exactly. Midnight, the TV would be gone, and there was this show. I'm not sure what station it was on.
It was here in the Triangle area?
It was in the Triangle area. It was all you could get, local TV. You'd get Durham, and a couple of Raleigh stations, I believe, but at about 3 minutes till 12, there would appear this aircraft. It would happen to be an F-104 that flying people will know, but it looks like a telephone pole with little short wings. It looks like kind of like a rocket with little short wings, but you could see a pilot in there with a white helmet. And this aircraft was doing slow rolls and maybe a slow loop, and in the background was the poem, High Flight. Oh, I have slipped the surly bonds of earth. And when that finished, it'd be the American flag and the national anthem. At this time, war was kind of, quote, end quote, honorable. We were coming out of two great wars, and there was this chance to fly this thing. And so I had my sights set on doing that someday.
Mm-hmm. And this would have been in the 50s when you were...
Yes, this was actually early 60s when I was just in the 8th, 9th, 10th grade around in there. I think that's when they were showing the film.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe before, I'm not sure.
Yeah. And so you eventually do sign up for the Air Force.
Well, I found out that all I had to do was walk into the ROTC office in Chapel Hill when I was accepted and admitted, and I walked into the ROTC office. That was a 4-year program then. I think it's 2 years now. And I said, I want to fly. Can I be a pilot? And they said, yeah, just sign up, and if you pass all the physicals and if everything is fine, you'll fly. And so for 4 years, I waited until my senior year, and they checked me out in a little airplane, and then I went on to pilot training.
Mm-hmm. So you had never really flown before then?
I had not flown when I walked into that office and said, I want to fly an airplane. I'd never been in an airplane. Later, as a college student, I flew once. And then when I started to, and after I finished college, when I flew away to my pilot training in Texas, I'd never flown commercially. But I did have to. Lie. The guy told me when I started to sign up, he said, out of the blue, he said, have you ever had asthma? And I said, yes. He said, well, if you say that you've had asthma on this application, you will never fly. So I lied about that, and somehow I made it in and passed all the physicals and all the other kinds of tests, and I was able to fly in the Air Force for 5 years.
That gives a little more resonance then to a story that you tell in Solo about, I can't remember if it was on a training mission or I imagine it was a training mission, and you had an Air Force, somebody of higher rank behind you, and he pinches the tube that's giving you oxygen.
Yes, actually, this was...
to what end?
This was a small aircraft, a small jet trainer, and we were sitting side by side.
Yeah.
And he was on my right, I was on the left, and he was an instructor who was known as a screamer. About over 50% were known as screamers. We knew who the screamers were.
Meaning?
Screamer meaning this. He would say something to me. Like, I'd be flying along and say, okay, Edgerton, you're a couple hundred feet low. And, you know, you're wearing an oxygen mask, and you're getting oxygen. That's how you breathe, and you're talking through your oxygen mask. Now, I won't use a profanity. I'll leave that out. I'll beep that out or whatever. But he says, okay, you're a couple hundred feet low, Edgerton. And Edgerton, you're 100 feet low now, and you're not moving up like you ought to be. Pause. And then he reaches over, and he grabs the oxygen hose, and he squeezes it shut so that I can't breathe. He says, beep, beep, Edgerton, beep, 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 beep. What the beep you think you can... Are you trying to kill both of us? And I'm going, and then he releases it, and I breathe again and catch my breath. And so we just this was a habit of one particular screamer, just to stop you from breathing while he screamed at you.
Apparently, if you couldn't breathe, it made you hear better.
Well, yes.
That's
the idea. It opened up your ears. And so the next day, if he said you're 200 feet low, you're immediately back on altitude.
Right. We're talking with Clyde Edgerton, the North Carolina writer of many novels, but now he has his very first piece of nonfiction out. It's a memoir called Solo, My Adventures in the Air. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. 1-877-962-9862. So you trained in the Air Force. This would have been in the mid-60s or so?
66 to 70.
Mm-hmm. Because
70.
You just wanted to fly.
66 to 67, right.
Was that the thing that got you into the Air Force, into the military, was, I just want to get up there in the sky?
I think that was mainly it, yes. Vietnam was not underway in 1962 when I joined the ROTC. And the idea of being part, again, of the military was an honorable one. I had uncles who had been in both World War I and World War II. And I knew that I eventually wanted to be an English teacher. That was my idea, but I could see spending 5 years flying airplanes. So in 1966, when I entered pilot training, Vietnam was just beginning to heat up. And after that 1 year, 66 to 67, I had an option to choose whether to go to Vietnam, Japan, or stay in the States, knowing that the next assignment would be Southeast Asia. And I chose Japan and was in Japan for 18 months before I went to Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm. You write here that you think your father was not wild about you doing this, but that you, at the time, said you supported the war in Vietnam.
Oh, yes.
What were your dad's views on that?
Because he was from the South at that time in the 50s, as most other Southerners, was a Democrat. This is coming out of the Civil War. Not that he was alive in the Civil War, but the family... were all Democrats, and for some reason, in the 64, I was an ardent supporter of Barry Goldwater, and could not talk him into voting Republican. But we didn't really talk specifically about politics. It was just the act of flying an airplane that frightened him. Water, you know, getting in a boat, flying an airplane, driving an automobile in the mountains, all made him very nervous. And he sort of projected that onto me and wanted me not to do any of those things. I guess if, on the other hand, my mother was very supportive of me doing whatever I wanted to, including flying airplanes. And so I just chose to sort of follow her nod rather than my father's. And so, but it was never any animosity between us about it. It was just he was very reluctant.
Mm-hmm.
About these things, and I knew he was nervous about the, and I tried to write him comforting letters, which weren't all that comforting as I reread them.
Really? What do you think if you had been the recipient of such a letter?
I think I would have. It's hard to say. I would have been as upset as he was probably. I was explaining what was going on over there, not realizing that it would probably frighten him. I looked back at those letters and published some of those letters in the book.
Right. So. Your feelings going into it were that you supported this war, but you have, perhaps in the passage of time and passage of just a year or two in Southeast Asia, your views of that changed.
Probably the story is best summarized by saying that I did work for Barry Goldwater in 64. And when I got out of the Air Force in 71, I went to work in 72 for George McGovern, who was a, quote, end quote, peace candidate at the time. In the meantime, in 68, though, I remember Kissinger and Nixon saying, peace with honor, and we have a plan for getting out of Vietnam. And that was one reason I supported his candidacy, because by that time I was beginning to feel like we needed to get out. And once I was in the war, involved there, I realized the complexity. I realized it was not the simple issue I had been led to believe it was.
Mm-hmm. And you also write here about going off and trying to do search and rescue missions for to find downed pilots.
Correct. That was one of my jobs.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if there's a parallel to be drawn there, because you write about doing those missions, and they were rather dangerous, and you had to rely so much on the training you had. You say that the training is what got you through that. And it almost sounds banal to say that, but you couldn't let panic get in the way. It's like you just went on remote. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, people in war, different people go through different situations, of course, and people on the ground face a more harrowing experiences in general than people in the air, at least while they are in the air. And although it was frightening for me to do some of what I had to do, for example, to get these downed pilots out or to attempt that, I had been thoroughly trained, and what I was doing was almost reacting mechanically. I knew what to do. I knew how to do it. And I flew places in situations which were very dangerous. But looking back on it, I realized that to not have done those things would have been more difficult than to have done those things. It was an automatic kind of reaction. And it makes it more difficult for me to take any kind of credit for that, because that was the only thing to do. Whereas in certain situations on the ground, I think you have thoughts about courage that may be different from the ones I had. I didn't see myself as particularly courageous.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you might give us one more reading here. And this is from the end of the book, where you tie up some of these ends about flying and flying in Vietnam.
I will say that while I was writing the book, and I would write about something that was going on in the war, and I would recall and remember and have doubts, et cetera. And my editor suggested I move all that to the end of the book, which I did. And so you'd like for me to read this now, correct?
Sure. Okay.
A man with an airplane flies into the air, into physical danger. Let's say his mission is a combat mission. The chances are he will return, and when he does, he will have enjoyed the flight, probably in direct proportion to the danger he faced and evaded during the flight. And even if he didn't enjoy it, he will enjoy discussing it, reliving it, owning the experience forever. And he will have been trained back in the States with friends in ways that are generally enjoyable. I might add that this could be she in this day and time. He will have been thoroughly trained to handle most of the situations he confronts. He will work with men who normally think and act as he does. He may win medals, as I did, that proclaim his courage. And while there's no doubt about the bravery of many soldiers, sailors, and airmen under far more trying conditions than I've ever faced, especially the bravery of those facing death, of POWs, what about the women? What about the woman with two kids who doesn't have the means to take care of them, but who does so day after day and night after night for years, without training, sometimes without friendship, and without hope of help or of a distinguished flying cross? We tend to think of courage only as something shown by men in battle over a relatively short time. It did not take a lot of courage for me to do what I did in the war, and given the conveniences in my life, it'll probably take far less courage to raise my son than the courage shown by so many mothers and fathers in my country and around the world, in places our nation and other nations will not venture to give aid, but will venture to make war. When the combat flying is over for the young pilots in any nation who have followed me down my path, many will feel courageous, some with good reason perhaps, but only a few will grow to feel about their experience as I do now, that the pull of the flying machine, the dream of flying, seduced me. Late in the war, I wrote in my journal a quote from somewhere, quote, there is no country but the heart, end quote.
Clyde Edgerton reading from his newest book, Solo, My Adventures in the Air. We'll get with more of our conversation with Clyde Edgerton in just a moment. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Penkova, and we're talking this hour with writer and novelist Clyde Edgerton. His new book is called Solo, My Adventures in the Air. It's a memoir, which is a departure for Clyde Edgerton, who has written novels to now. And the memoir maps his journey as a pilot as well as being a writer. State for us again, what is it about flying that draws you to the air?
I think several things. One is the immediate feedback you get relating to the skill that you've developed. You can see if you're doing a good job or not. For example, in landing, you know right away, and anybody else is in the aircraft knows if you've made a good landing or not. And while normal to have an occasional bad landing or rough landing, you know immediately how well you've done. And I think in other tasks, especially if you're teaching or if you're writing, instant feedback is not there. So that's one thing. Another thing is being in the air and flying and being in control. If you've ever had people who've had dreams of flying, if it's a good dream, you're just off the ground and you're moving along, and it's a feeling of feeling of power, a certain kind of power that you don't get in other places. That almost dreamlike state can take over. And if you're alone, you are alone in a way that's almost magical at times when you're flying also.
I know the name of your book is Solo, and in the introduction you read a little while ago, talking about trying to land that spoon on the toothpick on the long dining room table, you did talk several times about being solo, the solitude of it, as a good thing.
Exactly. It seems to be a kind of solitude that's hard to find. I think people who... Well, I'm not sure. I think I've tried a little meditation, but I think there are places you can get mentally that you can get in the air alone that may be similar, that seem to be completely, totally alone. And you come back from that, and you need a certain amount of skill to get back. And so it's a good feeling. You develop confidence, and out of that confidence comes a certain kind of security in the air. If you fly enough, you have to fly at least once a week once a week, in my view.
Do you fly now?
I do not fly now. I haven't flown since the little problem with Annabelle and the crash in 91.
Well, we should explain Annabelle. You came home from Vietnam in the early 70s, and then a good decade passed before you found this Piper plane.
I flew off and on for 15 or so years. A year or so I wouldn't fly, then I'd fly a little bit. But I was flying these little commercial aircraft, which didn't seem much fun. And then I stumbled upon the fact that I could own one that was more exciting feeling and looking to me. One you flew with a stick and a throttle on the left. It was built in 1946. So I bought that in 1989 and flew it for 2 years. And then unfortunately flipped it over on the top on takeoff one day. And I haven't flown since. It takes a good bit of time, and now especially, more so than in the late 80s, a good bit of money and a good bit of time, both of which I don't have enough of to deal with the sport right now. But if things change, I might have another airplane.
Mm. Mm. So where do you go for solitude then, if not the skies?
As I said before, occasionally I do a little bit of meditation, so I can do that. And I have an office.
You don't have to worry about the landings then.
Right. I also I also own a little front end loader, a Bobcat that's much like an airplane. I bought a used one years ago, and I can get in that and do work, and I get some of that same solitude.
Is the sound the same? Because I imagine it's loud in a cockpit. Only been in a small plane once.
Oh, really?
Is it as loud?
It's louder than an airplane, but there's something about being in the machine. It's just something personal with me. I always wanted to drive. My mother let me drive cars, by the way, when I was 8 or 9. I would sit in her lap and drive, and then when I was 12, I was driving alone on country roads. For some reason, she wanted me to do that, and I bought into the whole business of maneuvering a machine around. And before I got my driver's license, I was counting down the days from 9 months before. Every day I would count the day, which is, of course, made it longer. Yeah. But I just enjoy that kind of activity.
So what do you move around with the Bobcat?
Oh, large rocks, earth, tree stumps.
They may need you for some hurricane cleanup detail.
I've thought about that.
Yeah, yeah. So you've been a fiction writer for most of your career, and this is a memoir. I'm wondering how it compared to write this.
Well, it was surprising. It was different in quite a few ways. If I can start backwards with the revision at the very end, once I'd finished this memoir, it was like I could not quite finish. And one of the reasons I've decided is because the voice in the memoir is my own voice speaking. And I was obsessed with getting everything just exactly right. In fiction, more often than not, the voices are of characters I've made up. So they do their bit, and I leave them alone. I don't worry about them anymore. They've said what they had to say, and I can't fix it. It's up to them. So there's a sort of a separation from the fiction once it's being finished that was not so with the memoir. So I spent a lot of time piddling with it once it was finished.
You going back to writing fiction now?
I'm working on a novel, yes.
Oh, do planes feature in it at all?
Not yet.
Okay. No, you did have a foray into planes and writing years back with your novel, The Float Plane Notebooks, and you made a reference here in this memoir to meeting a man at Lake Wheeler in Raleigh, and the image of this was where you described seeing him trying to unload from a trailer behind his car, this really improbable craft, which was essentially wings and an aluminum lawn chair.
Yeah, it was wonderful for any fiction writer to come upon a contraption like this. Was like a treasure hunter finding gold. This thing was sitting on a boat trailer and the wings were folded back, and it was a pickup truck, and there were two propellers on this contraption, and I walked up to the pickup truck and I looked in the cab. The door was open. The guy was pulling, a little short guy was pulling on waders and pulling on a blue football helmet, and he had kind of sandy red hair. And I looked back, I said, "You can fly that thing?" And he said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, do you need any help?" He said, "Sure, you can help me." So I went back and looked, and there was a stick and a throttle and an airspeed indicator on the dash, and a yellow and green aluminum lawn chair bolted down in there. And so we got it all unfolded and out in the water. And I'm holding the tail of it down on my knees on the pier, and he's sitting in there, and he can't get but one engine started. They're chainsaw engines. And he's got one of these little ropes with a handle on one end and a knot in the other end like they used to use for. So he finally gets that thing started, and he points both fingers out. He says, "Let her go." I turn loose, and he goes, wang, 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 out across Lake Wheeler. He never did get it off, back and forth. Occasionally it hit a boat wake and bounce up a little bit, but that's it. And 3 years later, I figured I needed to track him down. I was going to. I invented a character to have a float plane, and I could not find him. I called people who were at Lake Wheeler, and finally, after calling aeronautical people, were giving me leads on who to get in touch with, I get Marshall Sanderson. I got Department of Transportation. For some reason, they said he'll know who it was. I called him up. I said, "Marshall Sanderson." I told him the whole story. I said, "Do you know who this could have been?" He said, "Did he have red hair?" And I said, "He did have red hair." He said, "That would be Tom Purcell." So I called up Tom, and it was wonderful to talk to this guy who dismantled it because it wouldn't fly and built a second one, dismantled that one because it wouldn't fly and built a third one. And he had notebooks that he showed me. But before I saw them, but after I heard he had them, I also wrote notebooks into my novel.
Mm-hmm. The idea of he was keeping a log of his
efforts.
Yes,
and it was funny. It was all kind of little notes in there. Like he said, I finally got this thing in the air. Flipped for 100 feet, landed, started taxing back in, and it ran out of fuel. That was in his notebook. And he had little drawings in his notebook. So I made up notebooks like that for my novel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 27 years ago, you say, you watched Eudora Welty on public TV, and she was reading from one of her works. And that night you wrote something in your journal.
I said, I think I wrote, tomorrow I will begin being a fiction writer. And so the next morning I woke up and started seriously writing fiction because I knew the story that so well that she read, but yet I'd never heard her voice, nor had I seen her. And she made such an impression. It was one of those events that people have in their lives when things are transformed. And I knew that I'd been toying with the idea of writing fiction seriously, but I knew that's what I had to do. So the next morning I started writing fiction seriously and have been doing that since.
So you had the story already churning around in your head, and then did you just need to see how somebody did it? But you certainly had read books before. You knew people wrote books.
I had actually written a complete short story, The Christmas before the May that I saw that happen. I had 2 weeks. I wrote a short story, and I had written awful poetry in college, and I tried to write stories and couldn't. But I had finished a short story, but I was more or less playing around with it. And I think I had a secret deep dream, but I didn't have the confidence that I could ever be a writer. Being a writer was something beyond me. And then I think her voice, perhaps her accent, and perhaps the content of the story, which had to do with family, something that I knew as well as I knew anything. And I think I gained a kind of a confidence and a burning desire once I heard her voice and heard that story.
Mm-hmm. And so you sat down. Was it also the thing that got you started to just say, I'm going to sit down and do this the next day? Did it impose some kind of discipline on you?
Exactly. It caught on because the next morning I wrote, and then the following morning I wrote, and then I was looking forward to waking up and write. And the best thing that can happen to a fiction writer is to wake up in the middle of the night and say, I can't wait till the sun comes up.
Mm-hmm. You don't write in the middle of the night then?
Occasionally I'll write a note, but normally I go back to sleep and save the energy for the morning.
Mm-hmm. You know, years ago, the first time I met you, you were the first Southern author I ever met at a hangar in Raleigh, I think it was.
It was.
And you had, there's another story that goes with that. Well, I won't go into it today, but I may blog about it.
There was not a bathroom close by, and you walked around the corner, and yeah, okay, let's go on to the story you were going to tell.
What I thought was fascinating was that you had a hangar there, and I believe that's where you may have kept Annabelle, that plane.
I did, yeah, Annabelle was there.
But you also had a desk there and a rocking chair, and that's where you did your writing.
I wanted to have a place that I could get away and write, and it was of course I had to rent it for the airplane. Why not just use it for the office too? It saved me from renting an office. There was nothing really romantic about it. It was just financial, but it was a great spot to have a desk and to do some writing near the airplane.
What kind of writing did you get done there?
Well, at the time I was working on a novel called In Memory of Junior, which came In Memory of Junior and or Killer Diller. I had those two going about the same time.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, Clyde Edgerton, thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks, Melinda, for having me.
Okay. Clyde Edgerton is going to be doing a reading this Sunday afternoon at the Art Center in Carrboro for the Orange County Literacy Council, and that's coming up this Sunday in Carrboro. Clyde Edgerton is author of 8 best-selling novels and the new memoir, Solo, My Adventures in the Air.